This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 221, was recorded on May 28th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all around the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. The In Gold We Trust report has become an annual event in the precious metals market, and its principal author, fund manager Ronnie Sterfeli, will join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss all things gold, including precious metals and the mining stocks. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick has prepared another of his famous post-game chart books, this week focusing on commodities.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500, which just has not let up. This rally just keeps going. It's unbelievable for me anyway. But what's your take on all of this?
Well, needless to say, I'm glad I didn't short it last week when I had yet another chance. And you know, my hunch was right. I think that what's going on here is the market is more interested in central bank accommodation than the fears that are leading to that accommodation. I think that there's definitely a lot of reason to still be concerned about the economy and a prolonged recession as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. But it seems like the market is more focused on the upside as a result of all of that central bank accommodation. And I think that a couple of technical things happened. We both decisively broke above that 61.8% Fibonacci retracement. In technical analysis, when you get beyond that 61.8 level, it usually means, on a closing basis anyway, if you're past it, that you're probably going back to 100% retracement. Likewise, we just moved above the 200-day moving average, which is another aspect of technical analysis. When you're below the 200-day moving average, it's usually a downtrend. When you're above the 200-day moving average, a lot of technicians perceive that as an uptrend condition. So in the last couple of days, we've both clearly closed above that 61.8 Fib retracement, also broken above the 200-day moving average, as well as all the other short-term moving averages. And, you know, it just looks to me, Patrick, stochastics are kind of high and wavering, but looks to me like we're headed back toward all-time highs. Doesn't make any sense on an economic level. I think that most market participants are underestimating just how long the effects of this virus crisis are going to last and how negative they're going to be. But it doesn't seem to matter. It seems like everybody's pretty excited about the Fed continuing to be accommodative, and that's driving asset markets higher.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar, because the U.S. dollar is breaking down. I mean, we're essentially at this stage almost down to the 98 level and breaking multi-month lows at this stage. Is there another leg lower coming here, or is this just a small fake out?
Well, Patrick, as early as yesterday, I thought it was just a fake out because, you know, the support has been pretty consistent at 99 on the dollar index. And we dipped below that intraday yesterday, but not on a closing basis. Now, today, what we saw was an outright close, not only just below 99, but way below 99. In fact, below 99.5. It was 98.40 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. Now, we're still speaking just before the close, so in theory, a reversal is possible, but it's extremely unlikely. It looks like today is going to be that closing print signal below 99. And, you know, that's an important signal. I don't get really concerned until we see below 94.5 or so, which was the March low. But frankly, you know, that low happened at the beginning of the pandemic cycle. I think it's very interesting to see this. I was expecting this trading range to resolve in the other direction. So it'll be very interesting to watch in coming weeks.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude at this stage, well, at least the July contract, is still hovering very close to multi-week highs as we are approaching around the $34 level. Are we due for some sort of a throwback on oil, or does this keep going?
Well, we've been getting that throwback, that correction on oil, and it looked like, you know, okay, topping out, maybe reversing. But just in the last day or so, it seems like maybe that correction is ending already. We got on WTI not even kissing the 13-day moving average, which is at about 13.75. Usually, if you get just a small correction in an uptrend, it'll go down and touch that 13-day moving average and then move back above the 8 and the 5-day averages. We didn't even get all the way down to the 13 on WTI. We got below the 13 on RBOB gasoline, but RBOB is rallying off of the 13. Looks like it wants to retake its 5 and 8-day moving averages. WTI is already above its 5 and 8-day moving averages. So as much as I thought that this market was kind of overheated and due for a correction, it seems like we got just a little itsy-bitsy mini correction in the last couple of days. On the other hand, if I look at the time spreads on the back of the curve, they've been hit quite a bit harder than the front month has. Now, sometimes those time spreads are a leading indicator. They give you an early warning of what the front month contract is about to do. So maybe there's still some weakness to come. I'd say that based only on the time spreads. If I look at the front month price action, looks to me like we're already back to uptrend conditions. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the next couple of weeks bring us.
Eric, how did the oil inventories come in this week?
Well, it's very interesting, Patrick. We got a build on crude oil of 7.9 million barrels nationally. Now, in addition to that, there was also a build on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So if you count both of them together, it was a 10 million barrel build. That's pretty darn significant. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, which is the critical delivery location for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract, still showing drawdowns, drawing down 3.4 million barrels this week. Gasoline drawing down 724,000 barrels, distillates building 5.5 million barrels. So we've seen pretty significant builds on both finished products and on crude oil. You'd think that would be the catalyst to bring on more selling and maybe a deeper correction. But if anything, I would say that the recovery in price has been pretty much consistent with, as the data came out this morning, we saw a little tick down as a result of that build. It didn't last very long, and the rally seemed to start from there. So maybe the market was fearing an even bigger build than this. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because it looked like some form of a gold correction was happening yesterday. And then suddenly this morning, we pop back up, once again, holding some pretty good supports. Does gold still break out, or are you still looking for a correction here?
Well, I was getting all excited, just as you say, Patrick. It looked like, maybe we were seeing the beginning of a breakdown. But if anything, as I look at this now, what I see is really a pretty textbook, trading within the range. Yesterday, we managed to just barely kiss the volume-weighted moving average at 1685. And, it looked like, okay, maybe we were getting to that breakdown level. Nope, got a nice healthy bounce, and this morning we actually went and penetrated those 5, 8, and 13-day moving averages just briefly. We're back below them now, but it looks like, the bounce is on. And the thing is, Patrick, I have to revisit my outlook for gold, because what I've been saying, as our regular listeners know for many weeks, is, hey, folks, get ready for the possibility of a really big technical correction. I'm still super bullish on gold, but get ready, because, boy, when you have a stock market crash, it tends to pull the precious metals down with it. Well, I thought we were looking at a bear market rally in stocks. I thought that a really aggressive sell-off in stocks might be coming, and that might be what could pull precious metals down with stocks. We're seeing the opposite. So if I'm going to revisit my view on stocks, box and say, okay, looks like the bear market rally is turning into maybe a rally back toward new all-time highs, then I think we might be headed back to cycle highs on gold as well. I do still think that this market has gone awfully high, awfully fast. It does show signs of being due for a technical correction, but the impetus that I thought might bring one about, which was weakness in the stock market, looks like it's not happening.
So, Eric, let's just quickly touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, because really it's been range-bound for almost 2 months. And one of the tightest ranges we've ever seen on a 10-year Treasury yield, just pinned between spot 6-0 and spot 7-0, just bouncing around. Do you have anything new to say about the Treasury bond at this level?
No, I really don't. And, you know, as I've said in the last several weeks, what I'm really focused on is the bigger picture of where are we in the longer term story, not what's the next move from here, but, you know, is zero really a bound that matters? Are we headed toward negative interest rates? And what is the transition going to look like? I'm convinced within the next 5 years, we're going to get to secular inflation replacing deflation as the big picture macro backdrop. That's the really big, important story. Am I right about that? And if so, how's it going to play out? That's the question that I'm focused on in fixed income.
Now, Eric, this week's feature interview guest is Ronnie Stifferle. Why did we invite Ronnie back to the show as a guest this week?
Well, Ronnie is a fund manager, hedge fund manager, who's had a terrific performance record running a precious metals hedge fund. And in the last decade or so, he's kind of become semi-famous in the industry as the author of the In Gold We Trust report. Prior to this, the only way you could get that kind of detail on the gold market was to buy paid research, something like CPM Group's Gold Yearbook, which was very popular as well. This is, you know, free stuff on the internet. It's available to everybody for free, and it's really excellent content. So the publication of the In Gold We Trust report has kind of become the event of the season for the precious metals market. It just came out yesterday, so we wanted to get Ronnie on to talk about it as soon as it happened. So we actually recorded this interview a few days in advance, but it was intended to be the first discussion. This is Ronnie's first public appearance since publishing this year's In Gold We Trust report. And of course, in your research roundup email, you'll find a link to download your own free copy of In Gold We Trust. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Ronnie is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ronnie Stifferle, managing partner, fund manager, and research director for Incrementum. Ronnie is best known as the principal author of In Gold We Trust, which, you know, it's almost bragging rights, Ronnie. I can say that I remember the old days when IGWT wasn't that big of a deal, but it's really taken on a huge following in the last few years. You're up to about 350 pages of heavy-duty research, and it's free. So tell us a little bit about how this came about. Why is it free? Why are you giving it away? And how did you get to the point of doing this?
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me again. Well, I'm publishing this report for 14 years now already. I started writing it when I was an analyst at a bank, back then I kind of felt like the vegetarian in the big butchery because, you know, sitting in a bank and then writing about the gold standard and being bullish on gold is kind of weird. Then we set up our own company, Incrementum, based in Liechtenstein. And then the report got bigger and bigger. And for me, it's just cheaper than going to the shrink because, you know, there's so much in my mind that I'm reading, that I'm researching, that comes from conversations with other investors, with people on the street, books that I'm reading, newsletters that I'm reading, podcasts that I'm hearing. So this is basically, I'm distilling this into one big report. And at some point we said, okay, we really have to take the next step. And now we're employing basically 20 people to crunch the numbers, to edit the report, to translate it from German to English and also to Mandarin. So it's a big project now. And I'm really, really glad how it's turned out. It's probably one of the most widely followed publications on gold nowadays.
Something I've been saying since 2008 or maybe earlier was that gold is going to be the asset to own in the 2020s. I've got my reasons for that view, but it was very interesting to me as I saw the report, which was just released yesterday. Listeners, you'll find a download link to get a free copy of the report in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Ronnie, as I looked at the table of contents, I see that you're describing the dawning of a golden decade, which sounds like the same idea that's in my head, but I want to hear your version of why we're at the beginning of a golden decade. Why is now the time to really be thinking about a secular move in precious metals?
Yeah, well, we always got a leitmotif for the report. Last year, it was the erosion in trust. And I think that that topic was really quite spot on. And this time we said, okay, let's really make a long-term outlook for this upcoming decade. And so we analyzed the whole macro picture. And I think this is something that differentiates our report from other reports. This is, we don't really care about just the supply demand picture of gold. We try to analyze gold from a macro perspective. And I think that if we kind of zoom out a bit, the environment for gold for this decade couldn't be better. I think the world at the moment is really running out of safe havens. From our point of view, the relative scarcity is one of the most important topics to understand gold. So the stock to flow ratio of gold is like 64. So you've got an annual inflation rate of gold between 1.5 and 1 to 6% every year, which is already quite a big advantage when it comes, for example, to the money supply that is growing on average by 7.8% since 1971. So I think this relative scarcity and this solidity and reliability that you cannot be inflated at will in gold, very similar to Bitcoin, by the way, this is one big thing. Then I think that gold in this upcoming decade could take more and more the role of bonds. We shouldn't forget in 2008, Eric, treasuries were sporting yields of, I think, 3.5%. German bonds had a yield of 4%. Now, at the moment, you know, we're basically at zero or even below with most government debt. So I think the risk return is very asymmetrical. Now, with this whole corona crisis, I think that we can all assume that currency devaluations will be used to try to solve all the structural problems that we have. So this should also be quite beneficial for gold. And then we're seeing a renaissance of hoarding. And one thing that is really important, gold is extremely liquid. We're quoting a study by the LBMA that shows that gold is actually at some points much more liquid than government bonds. So this study is referring to the European Banking Authority's measure regarding high quality liquid assets. And for some assets, compared to some assets like some government bonds, but also corporate bonds, gold is much more liquid. So I think going forward, we'll really see this remonetization of gold. A second thing that I want to stress is we will, and here really the corona crisis is one of the biggest triggers, we will reach the limits of debt sustainability. So the International Monetary Fund says for the industrial nations, debt to GDP will rise from 105% now to 125% in this calendar year alone. And then I think, and this is really a hot topic that we will be discussing, hopefully, is we're seeing the end of central bank independence. So what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, I think Chris Cole said that on Macro Voices, he felt that capitalism almost died in the last couple of weeks. And I couldn't agree more. So from my point of view, this is really the point where MMT, helicopter money, universal basic income, yield curve control, and all those things will be implemented absolutely, absolutely for sure. So this in combination with the current price action for gold that we're seeing at the moment makes me pretty confident.
Ronnie, a theme that we've been focusing on here on Macro Voices for the last couple of months has been the evolution from a deflationary macro backdrop, which has predominated the economy for the last decade, in moving toward, I think, either inflation or stagflation, something that is not deflationary, but I think that we've seen so much money printing and there's so much more on the horizon that it's likely that we move into a period of secular inflation or stagflation. First question, I already know the answer, is do you agree with that? And I think there's a yes because I saw it in the report. But give us your version of that. Why do you think that we may be headed towards inflation or stagflation? And how would it come about? And what would it mean for precious metals?
Well, I mean, we all know from reading monetary history that gold is a pretty good inflation hedge. I think that's obvious. I think if we compare the current situation to 2008, 2009, let's have a look at tips, for example. Yeah. The volatility in March and April was enormous. So tips were falling to minus 0.6, I think. And then within basically 2 weeks, they rebounded to positive 0.63. And this was really the biggest rebound in inflation expectations that we ever saw in history. Break evens are currently at 0.7. And we've never seen a deflationary development like 2008, 2009, where the 5 year break evens were at minus 2.2. So what this is telling me is that this time around, central bankers were acting much more quickly and much more aggressive compared to 2008 and 2009. They've learned their lessons, but it's this time around, it's not only central bank action, it is also fiscal policy that is extremely aggressive. Until the end of April, we saw central bank liquidity injections of 10.4 trillion and fiscal stimulus of 10.2 trillion. So that's basically, I think that's roughly 20% of world GDP that was created just until end of April. So those measures, of course, are enormous, but we shouldn't forget that there's lots of deflationary pressure in the system. The problem is that basically in this kind of creditism system that we are in now, we seem to have reached the limits for loan growth coming out from the traditional banking sector. So we shouldn't always blame just the central bankers. We shouldn't forget that most of the money is actually created coming out of commercial banks. And I think if we compare like a really big long-term view, if we have a look at this inflation scenario, normally, and we quote Murray Rothbard from his wonderful book, The Mystery of Banking. It's really a great book. And Rothbard says, actually, there are three stages when it comes to inflation. So the first stage is when money supply is increased and prices, they hardly rise at all. So people think it's only temporary. And for politicians, this is like the land of milk and honey. Then the second stage is when suddenly asset prices start rising. And I think we've seen massive asset price inflation. Yeah, this everything bubble that Jesse Felder described so well. So at this point, politicians are basically facing a fork in the road. Should they either allow some sort of natural deflation and painfully reduce the excesses and approve a recession? Or should they continue with the path of cheap money and thus risk the third phase? And the third phase is this stage, and I think we could be on the verge from the second to the third stage at the moment, when the public perceives that the inflation dynamic cannot be stopped and that it's gradually accelerating. At one point, people just say, okay, that's it. We try to leave the system and choose alternative currencies and hard assets. Eric, I think it's no coincidence that Bitcoin is one of the best asset classes this year. It's up, I think, 25%. So from my point of view, we could really be on the verge of this third stage. Now, I don't think that this is going to lead to hyperinflation, but we shouldn't underestimate the time lag that we'll see from all those measures that were implemented in the last couple of weeks. It's a bit like drinking tequila shots. You know, after two or three, it really goes well, and then you have another one or two. And then at some point, you just pass out and wake up with a huge hangover next day. So I think that politicians and central bankers completely underestimate the time lag effects. Now, once velocity starts rising again, once the economies open up again and you know the whole sentiment is getting better, then I think is going to be the point when we really will see if inflation picks up significantly. But some of the reasons for rising inflation from my point of view are, you know, we're seeing much lower productivity. We're seeing that increasing, you know, populism, and we'll see probably less trade, less globalization. We're seeing that, for example, the whole ESG development is something really big. If you want to set up a mine, whatever, a copper mine, a coal mine, whatever, it's just basically impossible. So those are long-term effects that now meet those monetary measures and those fiscal measures. So from my point of view, inflation, it's not something that we should expect in the next couple of weeks or month, but it is something that we will see in the next couple of years. And don't forget, Eric, we're seeing $14 trillion in bonds at negative yields. Now, the biggest pain trade for those $14 trillion, of course, is rising inflation. And at the moment, I think the average investment advisor is 52 years old. So during their professional careers, they've never really experienced any inflation. So this will be a completely new ball game for many people in the industry. And I think that gold is already telling us, okay, friends, inflation is around the corner. It's going to happen.
Ronnie, you've expressed a view which is very consistent with what we've heard from some of our other expert guests, which is this pandemic was not the cause of the recession which is beginning. Rather, the recession was ready to happen. It needed a trigger or a straw to break the camel's back. The pandemic was the trigger that got it going. Please elaborate. How does this situation compare, say, to 2008, 2009, and what's your outlook economically?
Yeah, well, I think I've been on the show with you, Eric, in August last year, and I said, you know, a recession is going to happen sooner or later. And don't get me wrong, a recession from my point of view is something normal, something healthy within a cycle. But I think, you know, last year we have seen a yield curve inversion, which is one of the most reliable recession indicators, of course. We saw that the OECD leading indicators declined for roughly 20 months in a row. We saw that 70% of world PMIs were negative. The US was already in an earnings recession. Germany was very close to a recession. South Korean exports, which is also very, very sensitive to world trade, were down. So I think it was pretty obvious that the economy is weakening significantly. Now, I just finished reading the FOMC minutes, and they sounded very, very concerned. So they said, okay, they fear that many job losses will be permanent. They said basically the word medium term much more often than in the previous FOMC minutes. So this suggests that the Federal Reserve doesn't expect a V-shaped recovery. Actually, I don't see anybody but the stock market expecting a V-shaped recovery. So it means that the Federal Reserve will probably become much, much more dovish. Now, we have seen, and you did some brilliant shows on what was happening coming out of central banks, but we have seen from 2007 to 2014 that actually Fed total assets increased by 5 times from 900 billion to 4.5 trillion. From my point of view, at some point, it will easily go to 20 trillion. I think at some point, the Federal Reserve will start buying all sorts of assets. You know, they are now active in the junk bond market. At some point, they will start buying stocks. Of course, I think the Federal Reserve Act would have to be changed, but it was already amended 4 times in history. So this just leads me to the conclusion that the market is conditioned to further stimulus like Pavlovian dogs. But those dogs now are really, they're fat, they're sick, and they're old. So it needs much, much more food and much more stimulus to get them up. And this is something that really, really concerns me, because it means that there will be less market forces. There will be more interventionism. I once said it's going to be Corona socialism. And this is something that scares me as a libertarian. And this also means that after the Corona crisis, because now everybody is still kind of scared and nobody knows how this whole health situation is going to turn out, but the next crisis will probably be a debt crisis. Ronald Reagan famously said, to say Congress is spending like drunken sailors is an insult to drunken sailors. Now, I think for last year, the deficit in the US was already 4.8%, despite the fact that the economy was still doing well. This year, I don't know what the number is going to be, 14 trillion or 14% of GDP. Nobody knows. It's an election year, so they will probably spend a little bit more. But those numbers are just outrageous. And this just tells me, okay, we won't see positive real interest rates in the next couple of years. And this is then also a very, very good foundation for the price of gold.
Now, with the expectations that you have around inflation and so forth, normally that would be associated with a very bullish outlook for commodities generally. Of course, commodities have been really moving south pretty hard even before the crisis, and even harder during the crisis. So are you anticipating a turnaround for commodities generally? And does the weakness in commodities raise any caution flags with respect to precious metals?
Well, I mean, commodities, it's tough. You know, the last few months were probably as turbulent and unsuccessful as, I don't know, Justin Bieber's latest attempt for a comeback. It was just the CRB, for example, I think is down like 30% this year, and it's 72% below its all-time high, while the Bloomberg Commodities is like 64% below its all-time high. So it's tough. And we're writing in the report, the whole world is upside down, and that there's this great children's book called Opposite Land by Charlotte Rose, where basically she says everything is opposite in this book, what it's supposed to be. So socks were feet, and broccoli is meat, and behind is a head, and people poop from the head. So it seems to me sometimes like the whole world of investing is upside down, you know, with negative oil prices and negative yields now being, you know, it's just normal. So from my point of view, when it comes to commodities, it's really a tough call, and actually making the case for commodities is painful. And when I tell friends that I'm pretty bullish copper, that I think that oil is having a pretty decent risk reward, that silver looks fantastic, this is the point when people start ridiculing you. But that also tells me, okay, perhaps that's a good idea, because most great investments, they start in discomfort. They really should hurt, and they should, you know, give you perhaps sleepless nights. So from my point of view, commodities often come at the next stage. So first there's always gold moving, then it's normally silver. In silver, we saw a massive reversal from gold-silver ratio at 125 down to 100. So silver started outperforming gold in the last couple of weeks. And normally, the third stage is that commodities pick up relative strength. So we make a comparison and show the parallels between the 1970s and the 2000s to the current situation. And each time we have seen previously a decade of booming stock markets, very aggressive central bank policy, and this basically fueled a rally in commodity markets. So I'm pretty confident, because when our inflation view is right, then I think that people start buying real assets at some point. And I think that this fiscal stimulus, those huge infrastructure programs that are considered now and that will be implemented, this could really be the catalyst, compared especially in an environment where basically nobody is bullish commodities and valuations are extremely low. So valuations of the commodity market versus the Dow Jones are at the lowest since the 1960s. So I see lots of value in the commodity space at the moment.
Ronnie, a question that you posed in this year's In Gold We Trust report is, can gold substitute for bonds in portfolios? Now, of course, historically, the argument against gold was that it doesn't yield anything. Of course, bonds don't yield anything these days either. So what's on your mind here?
Yeah, I think that at some point this might really happen. Eric, what we're seeing at the moment when it comes to gold is that generalists are getting interested again. This is something that we haven't seen like a year ago. Let's not forget, 1 year ago when we published the last In Gold We Trust report, gold was below this 1360 to 1380 resistance. This is really, really hard to tackle, and it tested this massive resistance zone a couple of times. Then early June, we went above this resistance zone, and then gold really picked up momentum, and really it started according to the Dow theory. I think we're now in the second stage of this bull market, which is the public participation phase. So I see that many big institutional players are getting interested at the moment. I think the allocation when it comes to institutional players is extremely low, but we're seeing some hedge fund stars like, let's say, Paul Tudor Jones, but also Stanley Druckenmiller. He became a bullish gold a while ago. We're seeing Sam Sell, Ray Dalio, and so they already kind of rediscovered gold. From my point of view, and this is what we're doing with quite a lot of institutional clients at the moment, we're calculating for them actually what gold does to your portfolio. Eric, you know our reports, and we always emphasize that gold is not the answer to everything. It is not a religion. It's just something that has got pretty positive consequences for your overall portfolio. And I think we perfectly saw that in the last couple of weeks, where gold actually really defended your portfolio. It stabilized your portfolio from losses in equity markets. So I think gold did a brilliant job. It did exactly what it's supposed to do. And therefore, I think in this stage of the bull market now, more and more institutional players will come into the market. They will realize, okay, with 10-year treasuries, with German bonds, there's only very, very limited potential. And basically, with this whatever it takes approach to create inflation, to actually reach those 2 or 3% inflation rates. And at some point, I think they will say, okay, temporarily, we need higher inflation rates. I think this basically tells you, okay, guys, get out of bonds. And then I think this will probably stimulate real estate markets. It will probably be positive for equity markets, but it will be most positive for gold, which is the most reliable inflation hedge that you can have.
Ronnie, let's talk about the U.S. dollar. A lot of people think it's about to crash and the end is nigh. I don't really hold that view. I follow a lot of Jeff Snyder's work looking at the global shortage of U.S. dollars and the amount of outstanding U.S. dollar debt. Now, historically, there's kind of an inverse correlation between gold and the dollar. And I think we should point out, you know, gold has already broken to all-time new high prices in most currencies, but not the U.S. dollar, probably because the dollar is so strong. So how do we reconcile for U.S. dollar-centric investors, people whose portfolios are denominated in U.S. dollars? Is there a caution here that maybe the strength of the dollar makes gold less of a good idea than it would be for investors who invest in other currencies?
Well, I mean, you know, since the beginning of the year in dollar terms, gold is up 14%. Last year, gold was up 19% in dollar terms. Over here in euro terms, gold is up 16% year to date, and it was up 22%. And in other currencies like the Australian dollar, it is up 21% and so on. So, of course, the dollar is the strongest currency at the moment. Actually, there's only one currency where gold is not trading at new all-time highs at the moment, and this is the US dollar. So we reached new all-time highs in Swiss francs, for example, a couple of days ago. So this tells me, okay, the world still regards the US dollar as the safe haven currency. Now, we're kind of interviewing two good friends of us, Luke Roman and Brent Johnson. And Brent, as we all know, he's making a tremendous case for a strong dollar, while Luke Roman makes, you know, more this de-dollarization view, which is much more of a longer term negative case for gold. Now, Eric, I've got a very contrarian mindset, I would say. So we checked the analyst forecasts for the US dollar, or basically the Dixie index on Bloomberg. And actually, there is no analyst, not one analyst, who's seeing a dramatically or a sharply higher dollar index in the next 3 years. So the consensus is basically it will go slightly lower over the next 3 years. And this is telling me, okay, Bob Farrell said when all the experts and forecasts agree, something else is going to happen. So I think the risk is definitely out there that the Dixie breaks to, you know, if we break the 102, then it can go to 115, 120 pretty quickly. And this would basically cause the next crisis. Now, I think there's a pretty big fight going on, and this fight is called Donald Trump versus the market. And we know that Donald Trump doesn't want to have a strong dollar, obviously. And he just said recently, it's $6.2 trillion and we can handle that easily because of who we are, what we are. It's our money. We are the ones. It's our currency. So this reminded me a bit of the, you know, John Connolly back in 1971. The dollar is our currency, but your problem. And we know what happened afterwards. The US dollar devalued 50% against the German mark. So I think that Donald Trump, he is very, very much concerned about strength in the dollar. And we will see if actually the market will win or politics will win. From my point of view, I hope that markets will win. But we know that if the dollar breaks significantly higher, and I think it should be, then there will be a massive intervention from politicians, some sort of a Plaza Accord meeting, whatever. But in the meantime, if it breaks 220 or even higher, this will cause dramatic volatility and turmoil in many markets, especially in emerging markets.
Ronnie, I want to talk about the gold mining stocks. And forgive me if I get anything wrong here. Please correct me because I do not profess to be an expert on the mining stocks. But from what I remember over the last decade, it seems like usually the trend is the mining stocks kind of anticipate moves in the market and they tend to be the leading indicator that lead the price of the metal. It seems very, very clear that mining stocks are trailing the price of the metal here. Is that normal? And if not, what's going on? Why is this happening?
Well, Eric, we do quite a lot of relative strength work because I think this is most valuable in the market that is basically just trying to discount and anticipate what central bankers are going to do next. So I think that absolute prices are heavily influenced by, central bank interventions. Now, relative prices give us a significant amount of additional information. And what we're seeing now is that mining stocks picked up relative strength against the leading sector in the stock market, which is technology stocks. That's a fantastic sign. So mining stocks are outperforming technology stocks. Now, what we saw over the bear market, I mean, it was a brutal bear market. We saw that many, many companies, not all of them, of course, they did a good job. Yeah, they did their homework. So the profitability of the producers has increased in recent quarters. We shouldn't forget that debt was reduced. They're having much more capital discipline, cost control. We're seeing that margins and cash flows are higher. They even pay, and I think that's important because the Wall Street Journal just wrote that more companies in the S&P 500 have suspended or canceled their dividends so far this year than in the previous 10 years combined. Now, at the moment, Yamana Gold, Newmont Mining, B2 Gold, Kirkland Lake, they were all raising their dividends. So on a relative basis, I think that's a fantastic sign. Then we shouldn't forget that energy, of course, is a huge driver on the cost side, and that most of the currencies are extremely weak versus the US dollar. So from the weak local currencies versus the US dollar, that's a strong effect for most of the miners that are in Canada, that are in Australia, and so on. So from my point of view, the miners really, really look interesting at the moment. They've got the highest leverage on a rising gold price probably ever. And we are seeing that generalists are coming in. If you have a look at the charts and if you have a look at volumes, you can see that there's big volume in the large mining stocks like Barrick, like Newmont, and also in the royalty space like Franco, for example. So this tells me, okay, this is not only the mining guys that are entering the market. This is really the big generalists that are now start investing in the mining space. So that makes me pretty confident, but I'm absolutely certain that, with rising gold prices and rising share prices, many companies will screw it up again. They will do ridiculous M&A. They will start just stupid projects. So it is really important to do your homework in the mining space, to have a very close look at management and, of course, also valuation measures. I think it's a very demanding sector, but it's also a very rewarding sector. And this is why we enjoy investing in the mining space so much.
Talk to me about silver, Ronnie. It's an industrial metal, not just a monetary metal. That causes a lot of people to be concerned that in a recession situation, as you and I both predict, maybe silver's not going to do so well. But the other side of that is, from a ratio standpoint, the gold-silver ratio hit, I think it was an all-time high recently, and that, of course, would make a very strong argument for a recovery in silver. So which way do you see this thing going down?
Well, you're totally right. We've never seen a higher gold-silver ratio. It was at 125. So it basically means with 1 ounce of gold, you could buy 125 ounces of silver. Now, we know that silver is kind of gold on steroids. So it's much more volatile. And we've seen that, especially in the bear market. Now, from my point of view, if you have a look, and of course, industrial demand is much more important compared to gold. And gold, it's just 10%. It's not really relevant for prices. But when it comes to silver's supply demand picture, we can see several supply constraints working in silver's favor. So out of 8 sources of silver supply, only 2 are not in a state of near stagnation or even contraction. So from my point of view, silver is definitely something that you should be considering if you're bullish on gold. Investor demand is basically not existent. And when it comes to the supply side, we shouldn't forget that silver is primarily a byproduct. It is a byproduct of copper production, zinc production, and so on. And if you have a look at CapEx plans for for the big base metal producers. It was already supposed to be down big time before Corona, and now even more so. So I think on the supply side, there might be problems arising in the silver market, while when investors' demand really should be picking up, I think that silver can go quickly to, you know, 25 or even higher. It's just primarily from my point of view, and probably some silver bucks won't like this view. I think it's a function of the bull market in gold. If gold does well, silver at some point will dramatically outperform gold.
Okay, Ronnie, I want to take a trip to the dark side of the force. There are a growing number of investors, particularly younger and more tech-savvy investors, who would say, Ronnie, look, you know, nice try on gold, but look, cryptocurrency is the new thing, buddy. Gold is an antiquated relic. The only real value that it ever had was its scarcity, and cryptocurrency invents a better way of creating a scarcity asset. Forget gold. It's all about Bitcoin, baby. What would you say to that?
First of all, this competition between Bitcoin and gold is just ridiculous. I mean, it's like saying, are the Rolling Stones better or worse than, I don't know, the Strokes? It doesn't make any sense to compare them. I like both. I like the Strokes and I like the Stones. From my point of view, there are many similarities between gold and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was designed to be digital gold. We have now seen this halving a couple of days ago. So actually, the inflation rate of Bitcoin is only roughly higher. I think it's 1.8% at the moment. So it's roughly higher than gold's inflation rate. Now, in 4 years, at the next halving in 2024, the stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin will be 121. So it will be an even harder currency than gold in 2024. From my point of view, it's very binary. So If Bitcoin should still be around in 2024, and I think so, I think it will be significantly higher. I think, you know, we just launched a fund that is doing extremely well that combines physical gold with Bitcoin. And then we're doing something that we call vol harvesting. So we're basically making use via options of the significant volatility that we're seeing in the Bitcoin space, which totally makes sense. And we really want to embrace the volatility in this space. Now, as I've said before, Bitcoin, I think, did a tremendous job during the whole crisis. It is up 26.7% year to date. So I think that Bitcoin is steadily becoming really an asset that will also be considered more and more by institutional players. I think that in 3, 5, 10 years from now, it will just be normal to have a small allocation in digital assets, like it's normal now to be in alternative assets, in private equity, in hedge funds, whatever. I think this is happening. We're seeing many, many signs that really big companies are becoming more positive, especially because the regulation is now getting better and better. So it is not, you know, the Wild West anymore. People, they've got their regulatory framework in the crypto space now. And I really appreciate the fact, Eric, that there's so much young talent coming in. We're talking to so many, and I don't know if I'm old, but I'm 39 here, but there's so many young kids in the market now, and you start discussing gold versus Bitcoin with them, and you can see, okay, they're really bright kids, they're extremely motivated, they're great entrepreneurs. They really want to deliver better solutions to the market. And when those young kids start thinking about what is money, where does money come from? Is Bitcoin better money than gold, or is it better money than the euro or the US dollar? I think this is a really, really important discussion that is going on. And therefore, I really enjoy talking to those young people. And I think, you know, our view has always been that most of the problems that we're facing at the moment can be traced down to our monetary system. So this is probably some sort of the end game of our monetary system. We definitely came one chapter closer to the end. And Therefore, I think it's really important to understand how our monetary system works. And I think that gold is one, let's say, insurance against those developments that we have to expect. But Bitcoin is another good answer to it.
Final question, Ronnie. I'd like to ask your advice on a conundrum in my mind that's just been frustrating me, which is, boy, you know, you just couldn't ask for better long-term fundamentals for gold than what we have today. But, you know, the problem with that is everybody knows it, and it seems like a whole lot of people are all in, and we've gone really, really far up really, really fast without any significant technical corrections along the way. Are we overdue for a technical correction, or are we just going to keep moving higher?
Well, I agree with you. You know, sentiment-wise, I think that, you know, according to Sentiment Trader, it's not extremely bullish yet, but of course it is not like the super contrarian bet at the moment. Just anecdotal evidence, but a couple of weeks ago when, you know, everybody was crazy about we are running out of gold and there's no gold anymore. And I said, relax, guys. This is mostly logistical issues. You know, there's huge demands and an explosion of demand for gold, and there's an implosion of supply because, you know, there's no flights from London to Zurich to New York. But back then, you know, even my ex-girlfriend called me, and I haven't heard from her in 10 years. And she said, I want to buy gold now. And I said, okay, well, this is perhaps some sort of a sign that sentiment is now pretty positive. But on the other hand, you know, when you talk to institutional players and they probably will be the drivers of the next leg upward, they don't have any allocation in gold at all. So I have to say that, you know, we are pretty bullish on gold, obviously, because, you know, gold is rising in every currency. So actually, I also have to quote Bob Farrell again, because Dave Rosenberg, he always brings it to attention. And he said, markets are strongest when they are broad and weakest when they are narrow. So actually, this bull market in gold is pretty strong. Gold is rising in every currency. Gold is outperforming stocks now, and it's outperforming bonds. So this just tells me that we're really in established bull market. Somebody, I think it was Harris Cooperman, he wrote, this is an asset that you don't have to worry going on the beach, because, you know, it's gonna do well. Of course, there will be short term, there will be corrections, but you should buy the dips in the corrections. And our, as I've said at the beginning, you know, this is a decade view. And therefore, I always really enjoy reading Chris Cole's stuff. And I think it's great that you're having him on so often. And he has this 100-year portfolio. And what we did in this report, we calculated the 10-year price forecasts for gold. Now, of course, it's not easy, because you cannot do a discounted cash flow for gold. But what we did, basically, we used the money supply developments and an implicit gold coverage ratio. And then we did a distribution probability. And actually, at the end of 2020s, we arrive at a gold price at 4,800. Now, the interesting thing is the distribution is clearly skewed to the right. So this means that significantly higher prices are far more likely than lower ones. Now, if you say now gold will be at $5,000 at the end of this decade, people will say, you're crazy. This is impossible. But from my point of view, this is going to happen, because we're seeing so many things at the moment where we would have said a couple of years ago, this is crazy. Negative oil prices, impossible. Negative rates, the Federal Reserve buying, you know, junk bonds now. This will never happen. So I'm pretty confident that this 5,000 target for the next 10 years, which is obviously pretty long, that we're going to go there. And of course, there will be corrections, but I think the risk reward for gold is the best that I see in the currency space.
Ronnie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Listeners, again, the free research report is called In Gold We Trust. You can find the link in your research roundup email, or just Google In Gold We Trust. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Ronnie back on the show. And when I was listening to the interview, I immediately, when he started talking about the weak commodity prices and inflation and what will turn everything and the impact it'll have on the precious metals market, I immediately thought that we were overdue for a quick little tour around in the commodity market. So I'm looking forward to doing that right now and taking a look at where we're trading on so many of these different commodities during this crazy cycle in the markets.
Patrick, I think that is an excellent topic for this week's postgame chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the postgame chart book in your research roundup email. That's also where you'll find the download link for the In Gold We Trust report. If you don't have a research roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, as we dive into this week's postgame chart book, this chart on page two really jumps off the page at me, because what I see here is, boy, commodities in general just on a nosedive trajectory. And then we get into the COVID-19 crisis, looking at the middle of February. There's that bottom there at, what is it, 59 or so on the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And then you've got some consolidation, but never moving to a new low. Now, I don't think that we're going to have another worse crisis next week. So it looks to me like there's maybe an argument that that 59 on the Bloomberg Commodities Index was a low, I mean, a final low, if you think we're about to see a secular shift into inflation. But then I sort of think about it and think, wait a minute, my interviews with a lot of our guests have said, you got the right idea, but that secular shift to inflation is 2 or 3 years off. We're not done with deflation yet. How do you read this as a technician, Patrick? Is this a meaningful bottom that we should be thinking might be the bottom?
Well, in technical analysis, generally, the first observation you're simply making is that the predominant downtrend has paused and we're in a consolidation phase. And determining now whether or not that consolidation develops into a major bottoming formation, because a lot of technicians could easily see that as a, you know, bottoming formation, such as double bottoms and so on. But it also could be the midpoint of a continuation pattern. And really, I think that to step back, we have to kind of ask ourselves where we are in the current cycle, because the economy is sort of marching to the beat of a different drum than the stock market. And so we can no longer take just the bias of this V recovery in the stock markets driven by a massive flood of liquidity by the Fed, but rather commodities are really demand driven, which is about when will there be a true economic recovery. The interesting part for me is that it's going to be really hard for the demand for commodities to get worse than when you literally shut off the world economy to kind of fight COVID. I mean, so there is a legitimate chance that while the stock market may still have more bear market to go, it may be that we're in a far later inning in the cycle for commodities. And at minimum, commodities may stop going down. I mean, it's going to be hard, for instance, I think crude oil to beat minus $40 to make a lower low, right? And so you know, I think that it's entirely possible that we are seeing the bottom end of the ranges. But one interesting thing that will be very interesting to watch on commodities in general is that will we now enter a period of extended purgatory where rather than a meaningful rally, it's just we spend multiple years just consolidating along those lows. If you think about what gold did after establishing its bottoms in 2014 and 15, we still spent years discovering where the real base of gold was before the bull market started. And it's entirely possible that we're just witnessing that at this stage.
Patrick, let's move on to slide 3, gold. You asked me in the market wrap about this. What's your take on the technical analysis side of the gold chart here?
Well, you know, the one thing that the big debate everyone's having is almost the reciprocal of what we're seeing in that commodity index, which is that you seem to have a now overhead resistance on gold. And the question now, are people seeing this as a topping formation, or is this simply a consolidation of that last bull run and the continuation pattern is about to come in? Now, for me, the most positive thing that gold has going for, which it could always change tomorrow, but right now, gold broke back in April to a fresh 52-week high, and the entire consolidation has actually occurred above the February highs. And so there's an old thing in technical analysis that what was previous resistance now becomes support. And so it's really curious whether or not gold can actually hold north of 1700 in this consolidation, because that would mean that there's nice healthy accumulation that could be used as the springboard to launch yet another advance. And considering that the multi-decade highs of gold lie just north of 1900, it's entirely possible that if this consolidation holds, that gold may first try to go for a full retest of its all-time high before any bigger correction gets underway.
You know, Patrick, something that has gotten my attention the last couple of days is we've now got super contango, which we've discussed in quite a bit of detail and what it means and so forth with respect to oil. We've got it in the gold market now. Normally, there's a rule for contango, which is there can never be more contango than what's known as the carrying cost, the cost of buying and storing the commodity, because otherwise it could be arbitraged. If there was a really big contango from one contract to the next, somebody could buy and take delivery on the early contract, store it, and then deliver it into the next contract. Now, of course, with the COVID-19 crisis going on, the logistics of buying and storing physical gold and delivering it into other contracts is probably making those arbitrages difficult. But I think it's really important for our listeners to know, when you look at the gold chart and you see, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, $1,713. And by the way, it got down yesterday to $1,685. Boy, sounds like a low number. Well, that's the June contract. And if you look at the December contract just 6 months later, it's actually gotten to the point of trading $30 of contango, a $30 premium for the December of 2020 contract, as opposed to the June contract. Now, there's no way that storing that gold just for 6 months costs $30 an ounce. So that's kind of an anomaly that probably is explained by the logistic conditions because of lockdowns and so forth. But I think it's also a little bit of a signal that when we see this weakness in gold, it got down to 1685. Well, the only thing that got down to 1685 is that contract that's about to expire. And maybe the reason that we've seen weakness in the price is because people don't want to take physical delivery of that contract because of these logistic problems that exist because of the lockdown and so forth. It's just a little bit of speculation on my part that I could be off base on that completely, but something's kind of fishy there with that huge amount of contango. In any case, Patrick, let's move on to silver on page 4. What's this chart telling you?
Well, Eric, on silver, it's really interesting because gold was pushing basically 52-week highs on the upside, but silver was lagging in a big way. When it really got slammed back in February, March, and sold all the way down to $12, it was basically trading at multi-year lows all over again. And when gold was recovering higher, silver barely retraced 50% of its prior loss. And so the last week or two really saw silver finally trying to catch up. And so silver edged higher and now is approaching that $18 level on the upper boundary where all those highs were from September and the early first quarter of the year before the sell-off happened. And so this is going to be really interesting to see whether silver actually has the gas in the tank to also break to a 52-week high here or not. And so this is definitely one of those things to watch.
Let's move on and look at natural gas prices, Patrick. We've done quite a bit of coverage of crude oil, but we haven't really talked about natural gas. What do you see on this chart in page 5?
Well, it's interesting because NatGas continues to also have a substantial contango in it. And obviously, there's seasonality and different storage issues. And a lot of the big storyline of NatGas is really will these different shale producers end up having to shut down or not? And that will substantially impact the supply demand of natural gas, at least the supply side of it. And so it's interesting that we continue to see a massive lag on that gas on the downside, never really participating whatsoever on the turn, but it really does seem to have established the lower boundary of this current cycle. I mean, it seems that we've now throughout the year tested this kind of 160 level on the downside numerous times. And so it's really interesting to see whether or not this is finally where a short-term low established on natural gas and whether it could actually do something bullish. I mean, I don't want to say anything to get excited about it yet. I mean, there's no evidence that even the first inning of some sort of bull advance could even be underway. But it usually starts with an extended basing formation, which we can at this moment say is at least forming right now in that gas.
Now, Patrick, a really important commodity is iron ore because it's a proxy for Chinese economic activity. Australia's biggest export is iron ore that goes to China, and China consumes a huge amount of it, making steel and so forth. You'd kind of think, boy, it must be, you know, hitting a multi-year bottom right now because of the economic situation in China after the virus. But it looks like, if anything, you know, we're almost on the verge of touching a new high, really, that's almost a one-year high. What's going on?
Yeah, it's very strange what we saw in iron ore. At least, I don't want to say strange. It's certainly not what I would have expected if you asked me what intuitively I would have thought would have happened to iron ore during this entire economic slowdown. But really, it never sold off during March. In fact, it held up as we approached the latter part of March into April. It went and just retested the bottom end of its lows. And throughout the month of May has now broken to multi-month highs. We're pretty much edging to breaking out to a fresh 2020 high on iron ore. And I'm not sure what the supply and demand dynamics are driving it, but certainly this is not the type of a chart I would have been expecting when if you told me that most of the world was shut down due to this COVID.
Well, let's take a look at another chart, which is a very different chart on page 7, and that's copper. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because in many ways, copper is a proxy for the real economy. It's a proxy for industrial demand. China uses a whole lot of it. You'd think that, okay, we looked at iron ore, let's look at copper. It'll probably be a very similar chart, totally, completely different. What do you see in this chart?
Well, this is exactly it. Like, iron ore held up very well, but copper took it pretty hard. I mean, we went at the start of the year, we were trading as high as 287, and then on an intraday basis, we're approaching $2 on the bottom end of the range during the very heavy sell-off. So very, very strong selling during the cycle. And really, the recovery looks very much like a chart on the emerging markets or something, where we had a very heavy sell-off, and it's just retracing that very in a reflexive rally, that move on the upside. And so this to me seems far more a reflection of what I actually would have thought we would have seen in the iron ore chart, and we're not. But the interesting part that will be the real tell for me is that copper established some very important lows originally in the summer of 2019, and now the rally is just approaching a retest of that, what it will now be an overhead resistance level. And I think the real tell on Dr. Copper in terms of the health of the economy will it be able to behave in a bullish manner and break this out. Now, I personally am quite bullish copper in the long term, in the bigger picture, but I do think it will be quite sensitive to this actual economic cycle. And so whether or not copper manages to undo all of the early part of the year selling, or whether it rolls over here, I think is going to be a really important tell that we should not ignore.
Patrick, one of the tricks of the trade that housing analysts use is they look to lumber futures as a proxy for demand in residential construction, because that's where most of the lumber gets used. What is this lumber chart showing us on page 8?
Well, I was just going to point out that isn't it amazing that the lumber chart actually echoes the copper chart. And therefore, it's the two commodities I think that are worth watching to actually really see whether there is a true V recovery coming in the economy. Because I'm more of the U-shaped recovery kind of in that camp. But yet, if we really saw copper and lumber legitimately undo almost all of that selling and recover higher, that may mean that things are a little more optimistic than maybe we're giving them. But right now, I think that lumber and copper are approaching key levels where if they were going to reject and, let's say, head back down to retest those lows, I'm not necessarily forecasting lower lows on either of the two commodities, but usually if there's going to be an extended recession and prolonged period, then we should go and see a retest of the lows and establish a core base from which the major lows will or the next major bull market will use as a foundation for a rally. And so these are two commodities that I think are must watch for anyone who's really trying to get a pulse on what's really developing.
Patrick, uranium is a commodity that certainly Marin Katusa has emphasized on the program. We've had a couple of other guests mention it. But holy cow, look at this recovery profile. What's the backstory to explain why in this, even during the crisis before the recovery really began in the middle of March, you can see a bottom there and just straight up from there. What's going on?
Well, the prices of uranium, like Marin was talking about, are actually considerably below their cost to produce. And that a large part of that was because there was a huge supply, excess supply that had to be worked through the system. And one of the things that we saw was that with this COVID shutdown, it actually shut down a whole wave of different production of uranium and a lot of the uranium mining projects, which has allowed a lot of that supply now to actually be worked off the system, which means that uranium has to more than likely continue heading to a level where it's actually economic for a lot of these uranium producers to actually produce it, which some argue is in that approaching $40 level. And so this rally, while it looks like it's been a big one, it may actually still have a little bit of more meat on the bone, and there might still be some further upside for uranium prices.
And of course, Patrick, these kinds of chart books and little updates on the market is what you do every day at Big Picture Trading. Listeners, as described on page 10, you can sign up for a free trial at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for today's show. This episode was made possible by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the In Gold We Trust report that Ronnie provided, as well as this post-game chart book we just finished discussing. You'll also find a link to a great interview with Cullen Roche, as well as a Jeffrey Snyder article titled, "The Optimists Have Some Terrible News for the V." And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit bigpicturetrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.